It's a pleasure and an honor for me to introduce Gerard Barnaton, who's giving the next plenary talk. Gerard got his PhD from Princeton University under the guidance of Ed Witten, whose picture we saw, those of you who went to Ilana's talk. And later, as he puts it in his website, did time at Harvard, Hebrew University, Berkeley, and MSRI, and is now at the University of Toronto, where he's been for 6 years or so?
10.
10 years, okay. Dror has done very innovative work, especially in the theory of knots. His work has enlightened the community on such things as modern developments as Diselyev invariants, and more recently, Klovanov homology. He's one of the leaders in the field. He has a fabulous website that I encourage you all to visit. Just Google his name or Knot Atlas. It has everything you'd want to know about knots and then some. Gerard's talk today is, I think, on another new idea which may bear lots of fruit. It's called metagroups, meta bicross products, and the Alexander polynomial.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. And I'd like to remind everybody who just came in that my talk will follow a handout. And there are copies of the handout in the back, and it will be useful for you to have a copy. And maybe even before I start, let me point out the ugliest bit of my talk. Here it is. Okay? So it's messy, ugly formulas, but on the other hand, that don't seem to have much meaning, but on the other hand, all that there is here is basic arithmetic, so it's not too bad. Okay? And, a word about my abstract. I mean, it clearly indicates that I suffer from a major inferiority complex. So, you know, basically I do knot theory, right? Which is, you know, about sort of stinking shoelaces and how you tie them up or how they get tangled up. And how does this compare to, categorified harmonic analysis on Kähler quantum manifolds, okay? Which is what everybody else is doing when they rest. So here is my bit of rationalization of why is knot theory anyway interesting. And the reason why it's interesting is essentially that it's as natural as number theory. And, you know, if you look around, you'll see many bank logos that involve knot theory. If you look at the carpets outside, you'll see that they involve knot theory. So, I mean, it's as natural as number theory, and, you know, just as number theory, it's surprisingly interesting. So, number theory, you know, your first thing, it would be about 212 times 317 is equal to something. I don't know what it's equal to. But, you know, maybe that's what you think when you're in third grade, but later on, you realize that it's actually much more sophisticated than that. And the interest in it is not so much in finding quick answers to 212 times 315, or, you know, being able to do it mentally, okay? But much more in the sort of structures, arithmetic algebraic geometry, automorphic forms, God knows what else, that number theory forces you to study. So likewise, my interest in knot theory is not so much in because of the knots themselves, but because of the sophisticated topology, geometry, quantum field theory, and algebra that knot theory leads you to study. Now, I'm not going to talk about all of these things in 1 hour. I'm just going to talk about one tiny corner of algebra that came into the game that I was playing recently. And in fact, I'm not going even to tell you how it came in. it came in because I was studying something about two-dimensional knots in R4. You see, this is again my inferiority complex. I cannot admit that I really care about the tied-up shoelaces, tangled-up shoelaces. It has to be two dimensions in R4, okay? But anyway, allow me to go through my complex, okay? So anyway, I was doing something about two-dimensional knots in R4, and again, you can visualize them either as three-dimensional things which occasionally go into the fourth dimension, so they vanish a little bit from sight. So this is a piece of a two-dimensional knot in R4. Or alternatively, you can view them as movies of one-dimensional things in R3. So this is another view of two-dimensional knots in R4. And I was looking at something that has to do with finite type invariants, universal finite type invariants of these things. And I came up with sort of an amusing algebraic structure with some amusing results that are associated with it. And that's what I want to tell you about. Now, I should say that this is not on your handout. However, it is on the web version of the handout. And the URL is on your handout, so you can find it. Okay? So I guess I always knew about the paper of Simosoni and Turayev. The other two, by Ledinet and Kirk and Livingston, I just discovered yesterday. Kirk, Livingston, and Wang, I just discovered yesterday. And I realized that they're extremely closely related to what I'm talking about today. So just, if ever you want to know more, you can also look at these things. Anyway, let me now start for real. So first of all, what am I studying? I'm studying knots. Here is an example. I think the example basically defines what a knot is. For now, ignore all the numbering. All the numbering will come out, will turn out to be relevant later. So what's a knot? Here's one way of viewing knots. There are other ways as well. So it's a certain picture in the plane, which is made of arcs and so-called crossings. In the crossings, one of the strands that go through the crossing is distinguished as the upper strand, and the other one is the lower strand, and the picture makes it clear which one is which. And such pictures are... these pictures are not knots, they are only, the knots are equivalent classes of such things, because you're allowed to, in three dimensions, you would be allowed to deform the strands, to move them around. And a famous theorem of Rademeister says that two three-dimensional knots, or the two two-dimensional pictures of three-dimensional knots represent the same three-dimensional knot, if and only if they differ by a sequence of so-called Rademeister moves. And the Rademeister moves are Rademeister 2, which is clearly represents a three-dimensional reality. Rademeister 3, in which you have a crossing and a strand that goes underneath it. And the Rademeister 3 move says that you can move the under strand up to above the crossing. And again, it clearly represents a three-dimensional reality. And there is also the grayed out Rademeister 1, which says that you can undo a kink. And often in knot theory, Rademeister 1 is dropped because, first of all, dropping it makes various things easier. And secondly, it doesn't really change knot theory in any substantial way because, these little kinks commute with everything else. So you can always push them to the end of the knot and then just count them. So really, not modding out by Rademeister 1 is just ignoring one integer parameter, which everybody is happy to ignore, and it's not a major change. Anyway, what I really want to study, or what I further want to study, is what's called a tango. So a tango is, essentially a piece of a knot. So it's a disk in the plane. So the disk is here in dashed lines. And within that disk, there is a piece of a knot. And I think it's obvious what a piece of a knot is. And here's a picture. And again, it's modded out by those Rademeister moves. Now, why care about tangles? Basically, if you understand tangles, it allows you to apply divide and conquer methods to knot theory. So if you want to prove something about a big knot, sometimes it's better to prove it about the pieces first. I'll show you an example a little later. If you want to calculate something about knot theory, many calculations turn out to take exponential amount of time. And so if you cut the knot in half, then you have, well, half the number of crossings below the cut and half the number of crossings above the cut. And each half will be much faster to compute. So that's divide and conquer. And that's why it's sometimes interesting to extend notions from knots to tangles. The notion I want to talk about is the Alexander polynomial. And the Alexander polynomial is a certain knot invariant. So it's a polynomial that you can associate with every knot diagram, with every picture like this one. And it doesn't change when you do the Rademeister moves. So in particular, it's useful for telling apart knots. If you want to know that this knot really is non-trivial, that really you cannot undo it by some complicated sequence of Rademeister moves, one way to do it is to compute its Alexander polynomial and see that it's non-trivial. Okay? So let me tell you what the Alexander polynomial is and then even compute it for that particular knot that's written over there. So I'll give you the definition without trying to make sense of it. I'll just tell you what it is, okay? Or a definition, one of the very many that there are, okay? So basically, first of all, you mark the knot, and this is the green marking here. You mark the arcs of the knot with numbers 1, 2, 3, and for this purpose, an arc is a continuous segment. So this segment from here up to here is 3. This segment from here up to down here is number 4, and so on. So I number the segments 1, 2, the number of crossings plus 1, which would be 9 in this case, but 9 is equal to 1 because, well, maybe it's a round knot. Okay? So 9 is equal to 1 for this purpose. And then I create a certain n by n, in this case 8 by 8 matrix, according to the following rule. The positive crossings, oops, I failed to tell you that crossings have a sign. The sign is determined by some right-hand rule. So it's not terribly exciting, so I will just say that you hold one of the strands with your right hand in a certain way, and then the fingers are so that the thumb is pointing in a certain direction, and then the fingers either point with the flow or not with the flow of the other strand, and that determines the sign. Again, it's not terribly exciting. So if you see a positive crossing, there will be 3 arcs around it, A, B, and C. If you see a negative crossing, again, there will be 3 arcs around it, A, B, and C. And what you will do for the positive crossing, you will add to your matrix at row C and column A an entry negative 1. At row C and column B an entry 1 minus X, and at row C and column C an entry X. And likewise for the negative crossings. So for example, if you do it for the 8 crossing knot that I was showing before, you'll get this matrix. So I don't know, should we try that? So I don't know, let's look for example at say this crossing. So the C of this crossing is 3, so this crossing is about row number 3. And the A and B are 2 and 5. So in row number 3, entries number 2, 5, and 3 should be non-zero and specified as here. And believe me that I've done it right. Anyway, the Alexander prescription then says, remove one row and one column, and compute the determinant, and you will get a polynomial which is actually only well defined up to multiplications by plus or minus x to some power. Okay? So I actually enter this into my computer, and this tells my computer to look only at rows 1 to 7 and columns 1 to 7, and then feed it into the determinant function. And once I hit enter, my computer computes the result, and now I know that the Alexander polynomial of the note I saw before is minus 1 plus 4x minus 8x squared plus I don't know what else. Anyway, it's non-trivial, and in particular, this note is non-trivial. Okay? Is the Alexander polynomial clear? Are you all with me? Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Good. So what do I have to say about the Alexander polynomial? First of all, it's extremely quick to compute. Computing the Alexander polynomial is computing a determinant, and computing determinants is polynomial time. So it's no problem to compute it. However, within the computation, you end up moving away from topology, because you do Gaussian elimination, and you do row and column operations, and the matrices that you see along the way are meaningless, do not represent anything in topology. Okay, so the computation somehow moves you away from where you started. Now, it also extends to tangles. There are several extensions of the Alexander polynomial to tangles, and I don't think I want to go into them, but those extensions unfortunately take an exponential, the target spaces tend to be exponential in size. So even though the Alexander polynomial itself is relatively easy, if you want to extend it to tangles, the target spaces will be of an exponential size. And these two things together conspire to make it hard to categorify. So categorification is a big word, and in this context, all it means is a certain procedure that people have been doing to note invariants, and for a good reason. And it essentially means replacing integers by Euler characteristics of complexes whose homology is itself invariant. Okay? And the reason, so basically you want to replace every integer by a complex. And these two things make it hard because, if you wanted to somehow replace the entries of this matrix or the coefficients that appear in the entries of this matrix by complexes, you will still have to somehow preserve Gaussian elimination, and nobody knows how to do it. Nobody knows how to extend it to matrices of complexes or anything like that. And nobody expects that it will be doable, because what people expect on various philosophical grounds is that the Alexander polynomial will have a categorification, but not the steps in between that are meaningless. Okay? And on the other hand, if you try to extend to tangles and then categorify, so if you want to categorify these exponential size spaces that you see in between, then these exponential size spaces that you see in between also have a vast amount of superfluous information in them, because we're describing something which is essentially polynomial in a space which is exponential. So if you're trying to categorify these target spaces of these invariants, you'll be categorifying something which is way too big, and you don't expect to succeed. So hence I'm happy about what I'm about to show you. Okay, it seems to resolve these two issues. Okay. Sorry, all of this is was the introduction. And now I'll start with the idea, and the idea will fail, and then I will fix the idea, and that will introduce this lovely algebraic structure that I promised to introduce right at the beginning. So here's an idea how to construct a knot invariant. Given any group G, and a pair of so-called Young-Baxter pairs, okay? So two pairs, R plus and R minus, where R plus is a pair GO plus GU plus, and where R minus is a pair GO minus GU minus. And these pairs are pairs of elements in the group. And then, given this information, I have a proposed construction of an invariant. Namely, put such a pair of elements on near each crossing. So put GO, O stands for over, so put it on the over strand near each crossing, and put GU near the under strand of each crossing. And of course the crossings have signs, so put the corresponding GO and the corresponding GU, okay, the one with the same sign. And then along the knot, if you walk along the knot, or maybe along the tangle, say I walk along this tangle, I see an element of the group here, another element of the group here, another element of the group here, another element of the group here. So just multiply them in order, okay? And the products that I'll see will be my proposed invariant. So for example, for this tangle, if I choose to call this the first component and this the second component, well, I see here GO plus, GU plus, GO plus, GU minus, and that's exactly what I write here. And likewise for the second component, here I see GU minus, GO minus, so that's what I wrote here. And this is my proposed invariant. Lovely, except it completely fails. And the reason it fails is that it has to satisfy, well, if it is to work, I cannot just choose any pair of pairs of elements, but rather they have to satisfy the Reiter. I have to choose them so that the Reitermeister moves will be satisfied. And you can write down what the Reitermeister moves will imply on these elements, and very quickly you'll find that Reitermeister 2 implies that GO plus is the inverse of GO minus, and likewise for GU. And then Reitermeister 3 implies that GO plus and GU minus, and GU plus, I guess, commute. So basically everything commutes. And if everything commutes, then a word like that just counts how many letters there are of each type in it. So the invariant is essentially a counting invariant. It only counts how many crossings of each type there are, okay? So it turns out that it's even weaker than the so-called linking number. It's a certain sum of linking numbers, but anyway, it's not interesting, okay? So my idea is to generalize the notion of a group and see where that goes. So let me generalize the notion of a group, but first of all, let me view groups in a slightly different way. So let me tell you about group computers. So a group computer is something that can store data sets that carry group elements in it. So one data set that will be in a group computer will be the data set written over here on the left. And in this data set, there are four registers that store a group element. The register X stores G1, the register U stores G2, and so on. Okay? The collection of all data sets with these labels, with these names for the registers, is simply the group G raised to the power of the finite set X, U, V, Y. Okay, that's clear. Well, but the group computer doesn't just store data, it can also manipulate data. And the point is that I allow you to manipulate the data only in a very limited way. The group computer can do only the following operations. So, the most interesting operation is multiplication. Namely, there is an operation called MXYZ, which instructs the computer to multiply the content of register X with the content of register Y, remove these two registers, and replace them by a register Z that would hold the product. So the output of this operation will be a data set in G raised to the power UVZ. U will be unchanged, V will be unchanged, X and Y disappeared, and I have a new register Z which contains G1 times G2. That's the most interesting, and by far it's essentially the only operation that I really care about, but you could put in a few more. Okay? So there is an operation SX for inverting the element at register X. There is an operation EX, which is defined only if there is no register called X, and if there is no register called X, it will create it in the data set and place the identity in it. There is a delete register operation. There is an operation for cloning two elements. There is an operation for renaming two registers, so renaming a register to a different name. And maybe another interesting operation that I do care about is this merging of data set operation. So if I have two data sets whose sets of labels are disjoint, then I can create a new data set called D1 union D2, which will just contain the union of the information. So the union of the set of labels, and, well, I think it's clear what it is, isn't it? Okay. Then there are axioms. Okay? These large collection of operations satisfy some relations. The most fun of these relations is the associativity of multiplication. So, if you multiply X and Y and store the result in U, and then you multiply U and Z and store the result in V, this is the same as multiplying Y and Z and storing the result in U, and then X and U and storing the result in V. This is associativity. By the way, this notation, double slash, is newspeak for composition. Composition is always in the wrong direction, right? So it's time to change it and replace it by a new notation in which the composition goes in the right direction. That's what I mean. Maybe that's my only contribution here. Okay? So there are all sorts of other axioms, and here's another one, for example. So if P is the data set, well, G1 is stored in X and G2 is stored in Y, then P is equal to the data set that you get by deleting the variable Y so that you're left only with X, deleting or alternate also deleting the variable X so that you're left only with Y, and then taking the union of these two data sets. Okay, so that's another axiom. P is equal to this. Now, I'd like to make a distinction between this axiom and that axiom. So this axiom is in some sense linear. Well, the data set appears here once on the left and once on the right. Because you take the data set, you multiply two things in, and then again, two things within that data set, but you started from a single copy of the data set. Okay? And likewise on the right, so this is somehow linear. The data set appears twice. Whereas this axiom is in some sense quadratic. Because, well, on the left the data set appears only once, but on the right it appears twice. Okay, you need to make two copies of the whole data set before you can start writing this axiom. Okay, so what's a metagroup? So a metagroup is similar, namely it's a computer like that, except you regard the data set as black boxes. You're not allowed to look into the data sets. So all you know is that there is a big set of data sets, and there is a huge collection of operations between these data sets as the operations that were written before, And these operations satisfy the same linear axioms as before, though I'm not necessarily insisting on the quadratic axioms. So essentially associativity, but also the other linear axioms you can write with inversion and whatever else there is out there. And that's it. So in other words, a metagroup is a collection of sets, G sub gamma, one for each finite set. So if the set gamma is like the set of labels in a data set. So it's like X, U, V, Y before. Okay? And G sub gamma is the collection of all data sets with these labels, in which these labels appear. Okay? And then there are operations, sorry, and if you want to complain about the fact that I cannot do collections over the set of all finite sets, do complain. Or restrict your attention to finite sets of integers or something, you know, allow only labels in the integers. I don't care. Okay? Anyway, and then there is a collection of operations, m, x, y, z, and so on. So m, x, y, z will be defined on any g gamma in which the gamma contains x and y, and its output will be in g sub gamma minus x minus y plus z. So I've defined a metagroup, that's all. Now, let me give you a few examples. So the first example is, of course, the non-meta example. So you take G sub gamma to be G up gamma, where G is a group. That's obviously a metagroup. Okay, but that's not a terribly interesting one. So here's an interesting example. Let G sub gamma be the set of gamma by gamma matrices. So a gamma by gamma matrix is a matrix whose rows and columns are labeled by elements of gamma. Okay? So for example, here is an x by y matrix. So the rows are labeled x and y, here is the matrix, and the columns are labeled the same way as the rows, so I dropped the labeling. Okay? And the operations are, the operations are simultaneous row and column operations. So if you want to add x and y, then you'll add the two rows, but at the same time add the corresponding two columns. Sorry, not add, multiply. It's group, we're talking about multiplication. And likewise, all other operations might make sense. If you want to delete y, deleting y will mean delete the row of y, but also the column of y. And it's easy to check that all linear axioms are satisfied. And here is the proof that a certain quadratic axiom is not satisfied. So if you take this specific data set and apply the delete y operation, you'll be left with the 1x1 matrix A in which the rows and the columns are both labeled x. Dxy of P will be y column D. Okay? And, I forgot to tell you how to merge two data sets. You merge two data sets by constructing, by looking at the block diagonal matrix that has rows and columns labeled by, the labels of one set and the labels of one matrix and the labels of the other matrix. Okay? So the union, the merging of this data set with that data set will be the block diagonal sum, so it will be the matrix AD with zeros off the diagonal. And this is different than the data set I started from. So this meta group is genuinely meta. Okay? Now, are you still with me? Are you okay? How much time do I have? Okay. Now, the consideration which allowed me to construct an invariant from a group also allows me to construct an invariant from a metagroup, provided I have Young-Baxter elements, so provided I have elements R plus minus inside the data set corresponding to two elements. Okay? It's no longer just a pair of elements. It's just the abstract data set in which there are two labels. Okay? And the way it works is, so if you have such a data set, if you have such a pair of elements, you'll label the top strand with some name. You know what, why don't I go even further back and do it here? So you label, the understrand 1 and the top strand 12, and here, well, I guess I'll go in order. So the top strand here will be 2 and the understrand 7, and the understrand here is 3 and the top strand is 8, and so on. And I'll take my young Baxter elements and I'll store them in position 112. And then I'll store another copy in position 27 and another copy in position 38. More precisely, I will take the young Baxter element, rename the labels to 1 and 12, and then take another copy and rename the elements to the labels to 2 and 7, and then take another copy and similarly. And then I'll merge all these data sets. So now I have a big data set with 16 labels that stores in it 8 copies of the young Baxter element. And then I'll just multiply the element in position 2 with the element with the element in position 1 with the element in position 2. Put the result in some temporary register and multiply it with the elements in position 3 and so on. And then at the end, I will get an element in the data set with only one label, the label in which I stored the whole product, and that will be my invariant. Okay? So this is the plan, and the only problem with the plan is that I need good examples of metagroups. And, how do I get good examples of metagroups? Well, even in group theory, how do you get good examples of groups? So the first few groups you define by hand, and then after that, you start using constructions. You talk about products of groups, or semi-direct product of groups, or bicross products of groups. So let me tell you about bicross products of groups, and then extend it to the meta-universe. Okay? So what's a bicross product of groups? So if a group G is the product of two subgroups, H and T, for heads and tails, and by the way, heads are red and tails are blue. And suppose that the two subgroups, H and T, are essentially disjoint, so the intersection is just the identity. Then it's a lovely exercise to show that G is also equal to T times H, and therefore, you can show that the group is determined by H and T, so the full group G is determined by H and T, and one additional piece of information, which is the swap map, which takes a pair TH and maps it to the pair H prime T prime, for which TH is equal to H prime T prime. And you know that H prime and T prime exist and are unique because G is both H times T and T times H. Okay? Now, this swap operation satisfies some axioms. And let me tell you only the interesting axioms. So the two interesting axioms are that if you want to swap two tails across a head, you can do it in either of two ways. Either you first multiply the tails and then swap them with the head, and I think the diagrams explain what you're doing. And if not, then here is how it's written as a composition. Anyway, that's the same as swapping T2 against the head, then swapping T1 against the result, and then multiplying after the swap. So that's one axiom. And the second fun axiom is likewise with heads replacing with swapping heads and tails. Okay? And then there are a few non-fun axioms about identity and inverse, and I don't even, let's not worry about it. The point is that, and now, suppose you have two groups, T and H, and a swap map from T times H to H times T, which satisfies these two axioms and also the lesser axioms, then it's a minor exercise to verify that the rule written here defines a product on H cross T. And this product reconstructs the group from its two subgroups. So what's the product on H cross T? Well, basically, the product, well, if you want, it's defined down here at the bottom. If you want to multiply H1T1 with H2T2, the way to do it is to swap the middle two terms so that you get H1, H2 prime, T1 prime, T2, and then reparenthesize, and now you've written it as a product of a head and a tail. Okay, or pictorially, it's the picture written here. Okay, so in order to give you a group, one way to do it is to give you two groups, H and T, and a swap map from H cross T, from T cross H to H cross T. Okay. Now let's meta this. So a meta bicross product, or more precisely, it's the data that goes into constructing a constructing a group as a meta bicross product. But anyway, a meta bicross product should be a computer that can store two types of elements. So it has two types of registers. So registers that store heads and registers that store tails. So it's a collection of sets, beta, eta, tau, where eta is a finite set of head labels and tau is a finite set of tail labels. And for each two such finite sets, you get the set of all data sets with these heads and these tails. And then there should be operations, well, tail multiply, where x, y, and z are tail labels, head multiply, where x, y, and z are head labels, and these should satisfy the usual axioms of a meta group. And a further operation, swap x, y, where x is a tail and y is a head, and then also lesser axioms. And the swap operation should satisfy the axioms that were written here. And notice that these are linear axioms, so it fits within my general pattern. And then the little theorem is that given a metabyte cross product, so given a group computer that can store elements both in H and in T, you can construct a new one which will store elements in the bicross product. Namely, well, if you want to store elements in G, well, for each element of G, you need two registers, one to store a tail and one to store a head. So just define G sub gamma to be beta of gamma sub gamma, right? Because if you need to store gamma elements, you need to store gamma tails and gamma heads. And then define the group multiplication using this composition written here, which is this diagram or this, element-wise operations. Okay? Example. So here is an example of a meta-bicross product which isn't an ordinary bicross product. Namely, take the previous gamma by gamma example and split the rows and the columns. So define beta of eta and tau to be matrices tau by eta matrices over Z with row operations for the tails and column operations for the heads and just the trivial swap. So this is indeed a non-meta example, but it's not terribly interesting because the swap was trivial. Okay? Okay. And here's the thing that generalizes the Alexander polynomial. And again, I'm not telling you where it came from. So let beta of eta and tau be the following. So it will be matrices in which the rows are labeled by tails, the columns are labeled by heads, and the entries are rational functions in one variable x. Okay? And furthermore, there is an additional entry to the matrix, sort of a scalar outside of the matrix called omega. And omega is also a rational function in the variable x. So this is the space beta of eta and tau. And now I have to tell you what head multiply, tail multiply, what all the operations are. So first of all, the union of two data sets is essentially, so if I want to take this data set and merge it with this data set, it's essentially the block diagonal union of before, except the scalars, I just multiply with each other. The tail multiplication is the silly tail multiplication. So if you want to multiply this with that, you do it by adding the corresponding rows. The head multiplication is already slightly non-trivial, so the head multiplication of column X with column Y will be a column labeled Z, and it will contain alpha plus beta, where alpha is this column and beta is that column, plus the norm of alpha times beta, where norm is defined below. Norm is just the sum of the entries. And then comes the ugly formula, the swap. If I want to swap X and Y, well, the swap operation does not change the total number of registers I have. So the labeling will be the same. But anyway, if I want to swap X and Y, I first write my original matrix in block form. So alpha is the scalar at the intersection of X and Y. Beta is a row vector, gamma is a column vector, and delta is a matrix which is of size one less. Okay? You define epsilon to be 1 plus alpha, and the result of the swap will be omega times epsilon as the scalar, and then this horrible mess as the rest of the matrix. I have nothing good to say about this horrible mess, and I've admitted it at the beginning. Okay. And finally, I also have a pair of Young-Baxter elements. So they should be in the meta group corresponding with data set X and Y. So they should be tails X and Y and heads X and Y. And here is just this is the positive Young-Baxter element. And likewise, this is the negative Young-Baxter element. Theorem. The resulting invariant that you construct, as I explained before, out of this meta group is indeed a tangle invariant. So indeed it satisfies Rademeister 2 and Rademeister 3. And in fact it's more than a tangle invariant, but I don't want to get into it. And if you restrict this invariant to knots, the omega part is the Alexander polynomial, and I think I'll skip the rest of the statement and just tell you, why am I happy? So I'm happy because, well, it has applications to where I started from, the two dimensions in four dimensions at the beginning, but I didn't say anything about it before, so I will not say anything about it now. Two, everything I know about the Alexander polynomial can be expressed in this language, but again, I think I don't want to go through everything I know about the Alexander polynomial, so I'll skip it. I should say that it's also the least wasteful Alexander for tangles I'm aware of. Namely, the invariant of a tangle is valued in n by n matrices. This is a polynomial amount of information. So it's way better than the exponential waste of before. And every step of the computation, along the computation of the invariant, every step makes topological sense, because what you do to compute something, a big knot from the small ingredients, is you just multiply more and more Young-Baxter elements with each other, and you just get bigger and bigger tangles. So every bit along the way is the invariant of something. And finally, it fits on one sheet of paper, including the implementation, and I guess I have about 1 minute to go through the implementation, and I really mean it. Okay, so this part of the program is just aesthetics. It's just pretty printing of the results. Ignore it. This is the main part of the program. This does everything. All the definitions, the swap, the head multiply, the tail multiplication, tail multiply, everything is here. If I punch enter, it's now entered into my computer and the program is ready to be run. I can run it on, say, a beta element like this one, just to test this one of the axioms. And I guess, you know, the notation is exactly as in the handle previously. So again, I hit enter and the computer spits out true, so the axioms are satisfied and I know I can go ahead and I'll get an invariant. Oops, sorry, I first had to check that the young Baxter elements satisfy the Rademeister moves. So again, I just take a piece of the knot, label it as I should, and do the look at the corresponding young Baxter elements and multiply them using the operation, because right, I need to multiply along here, multiply along here, and multiply along here, and compare it with the products here. So here are the products that I get. Sorry, I forgot to hit enter. I hit enter. Here are the products that I get, and they are the same. So Rademeister 3 is satisfied, and in fact, I've proven it by divide and conquer. I didn't have to look at the rest of the knot. I only needed to look at the part of the knot, the tangle, which involves the Rademeister 3 move. So I'm happy, and now I can compute the invariant of 817. So I take, as promised, 8 data sets, young Baxter copies, place them in the correct places, multiply them together, hit enter, and I get a certain 16 by 16 matrix, but I dropped all the zero rows and columns, so it looks 8 by 8. Okay? And then I tell my computer to repeatedly do the following. Take this matrix and multiply 1 and k and store the result in 1 and do it for k going from 2 to 10 and at the end print the result. Enter. And that's an intermediate step. That's the invariant of the tangle that you would get by gluing the first 10 gluings that you need to make in order to construct the knot and not yet gluing the remaining 6. So this is just to show you what an intermediate step of the computation looks like. Anyway, now let's do the remaining steps. So the same operation, but k goes from 11 to 16. Hit enter, and the result is this. And James Waddell Alexander is looking at it with a satisfied grin because it's what he predicted anyway. Okay? And I'm running over time, so I'll tell you that I have a long to-do list, but I'll skip it. And I'll just end with some propaganda. So thank you.
Can you get any Alexander module things like Milner signatures in this setting?
So, not all, but some. So, the if you expand Zeta's power series in X, sorry, if you set X equals to e to the lowercase x, and expand these matrix entries as power series in lowercase x, then the coefficient will be various Milner invariants, as you would expect, right? Or rather, combinations of Milner invariants.
Uh-huh. But you can't, they don't become isolated, or?
No. I mean, in some sense, that's the point. It stores only what you need in order to compute the Alexander polynomial. Not the whole exponential vast number of Milner invariants, mm-hmm. but only the ones or the combinations that you actually need to continue.
Other questions?
Yes?
I mean, do I understand right that the Alexander polynomial is only part of the information that you get out of the construction, right?
For knots,
yeah.
It's the whole thing, right? But for tangles, you get more. As I just said, told Brian. But part of my to-do list is to understand what exactly happens for links. So there is something called the multivariable Alexander polynomial, and a tiny modification of what I've done, of what I've just told you about, contains the multivariable Alexander polynomial, and potentially more. But how much more, and if it contains more, I don't know.
More questions?
Yes?
So the Alexander polynomial can't distinguish between chirality, right?
Yes.
So you can't do anything more.
So, you know, I mean, this is a part of, this is not all of mathematics, it's not even all of knot theory, it's just a tiny part.
No, I just wondered if maybe
however,
there
should
be extra information.
I should say that the whole story is a quotient of a much bigger story, which when I'm hinting about this here. And the bigger part of the story, you know, may or may not do more. Okay.
Any questions? Well, does the speaker deserve a present?
Yeah.
I'll help you off.
Thank you very much.